Before we even get started here, lady, no baseball tonight. No baseball. The Dodgers did it for us today. Say more about that. Showbiz, though, continues unabated, Eddie. Unabated. Leave it to New York to get a nightclub comic to do a commentary, a daily column now, The Inside of the Series by Jackie Gleason. Leave it to New York to come up with that. I suspect the same paper will eventually have Sid Caesar covering the UN. And Jackie Mason covers the Wall Street beat, the fiscal lapse of the day. Deep insights on the Bears and the Bulls. Jackie Gleason in the series. It's as though the paper doesn't trust baseball to carry itself. It's got to get a name. I suspect eventually the sport page will be in charge of the entertainment editor. Going. No baseball tonight, friends. Going. No guitar tonight either, so don't get alarmed there. Already little old ladies are scurrying around. I told you, Charles, to write that letter to that station. That idiot is going to play that thing again tonight, and I wouldn't be surprised if that nut sang. Can always tell that kind with the beards. Boing. Good morning. How are you? It's all right. Well, I suspect that it's because it is a full moon. This moon tonight is fuller than any moon I have seen in a long time. I don't want to tell you what I think at times the moon is full of. However, it's a very full moon tonight. It's a wild moon there tonight. Boing. I feel tempted to do a moon show. About once a year, we do a moon show. And if you're very good out there, and stop your infernal, rotten, idiotic carping and complaining, just once, we might do a moon show tonight. Anybody there in favor of a moon show? Doesn't make a difference whether you're in favor or not. I'll do what I care anyway. At these rates, it's the only thing I've got left. I'll do what I feel like doing. I think it's a good night, though, for a moon show. And I was riding along tonight on my little thing there. I've got this little motorcycle. One thing about getting out of a car and getting out of buildings, you become very much aware that there is a world out there, and you are part of some kind of whatever it is, this thing, this nature, this thing here. We're trying to reduce nature to the status of a series of beautiful magazine articles by Life magazine, but it just doesn't quite work. The four-color reproduction doesn't quite achieve the goal that nature has set out for itself, whatever it happens to be. Grinding down of mankind, maybe, something like that. Speaking of forces of nature, oh, Ed, stop it. My old man was right. He said, for those of you who feel that from time to time you need a little word of advice from the hinterlands, I come from hinterland, Indiana, and they sure have a lot of deep bedrock advice out there. They turn out some of the nuttiest congressmen and senators the world has ever seen, but that's just part of local humor. You got to understand that a guy like Homer Capehart, I mean, with a name like Homer Capehart, he's just a local drugstore wit. Made a lot of jack, but stands around in front of the feed store and makes snappy cracks and jazzy remarks, and finally gets elected to Congress, and then he just stands around in Congress and makes jazzy cracks and nutty remarks until finally he leaves, and then there'll be another one and another one and another one, you know. Yeah, that's a funny thing. That's your radio. Why don't you do something about that? Look, I can't come out here and do a radio show with your radio making static like that all the time. Cut it out, will you? Cheapskate. I almost said something else. Well, nevertheless, since it is time to do a moon show, and as I say, I came from Indiana, where they do have a certain native, native idiocy. They're aware out there, more than here, perhaps, that they're part of nature. They can't escape it. It's all around them. It gets sneaking up to your knees from time to time out there, and it gets into your shoes and gets your socks wet, and it's there. And I'm riding around on my little thing today, and I look up at that moon, and I say, gee whiz, wow, what a moon. And did you see the wonderful cartoon? I don't often report on cartoons, but One listener who's written several letters, and I had a couple of times a sandwich with him and stuff, had a cartoon in the I think it was in Playboy, wasn't it? Yeah, it was the last issue of Playboy. Yeah, Gayon Wilson had a wild full page cartoon, Eddie. It was insane. It shows a paddy wagon. And it was a night scene. Yes, a paddy wagon there, full page, and it was in color. And there's a paddy wagon. The guy's got the back door open, and he's loading them in. And what he's loading in is great. He's knee-deep, and the whole street is covered with, and he's throwing them into the wagon, one after the other, a whole crowd of insane-looking animals wearing fur coats. And they looked like little wolves or foxes or something, an insane wild light in their eye, and he's dragging them by the scruff of the neck. And a couple of them got neckties, and they're wearing little short fur coats with little fur collars, and he's throwing them into the paddy wagon, one after the other. He's throwing them in, and there's about 25 of them. You can see they're all loaded into the wagon. Their eyes are red and glaring, and these two cops are looking very bored, and one cop says to the other, "Boy, I'm sure glad the full moon only comes once a month." Well, you know, it's a funny thing, but anybody who's ever dealt with mass, any kind of mass communications where the public, in a nutty way, is able to get back at you. You know, guys who make movies never have that problem. They make the movie, and 2.5 years later, it opens in some little movie house in Queens. Half the guys don't even remember the movie by the time it's open, so they don't have any contact with the public. Whereas in radio, there is a steady buzzing sound at this radio station, night and day, indignant listeners calling up. Just a steady buzzing sound. They don't pay any more attention to that sound than you pay attention to the sound of your refrigerator when it makes that noise in the kitchen. That's just part of the radio scene. You know, the monitors are going and the phones are going, you know, that angry bugged lady sound. Some bugged lady is calling up from Queens. And then you hear the operator picks up. Yes, madam. Yes, yes, madam. Yes, we'll fire him now. But he's on the air. We'll let him finish his program before we fire him. Okay. All right, madam. Yes, I'll tell Mr. Thank you. And that's the end of the conversation. A typical instructive, typical, honest, reliable, sober report from the populace out there. The bourgeoisie, as Mencken called them. The great slob world out there. You know, there's a new thing growing among radio listeners that I feel duty-bound to report to you. And I've been around long enough in this game to have seen some changes come by, and particularly among the listeners, much more so than in the field itself. The listeners, a very interesting new thing. And that is, there's a growing trend among listeners to, whenever he runs into a program he doesn't like on the air, mostly it's women, I must say this, it's an interesting problem, but mostly it's women, to call up and instantly want that program taken off the air now because I don't like it. That's it. That's it. It never seems to occur to them that all I got to do is turn the knob. You know, there's a lot of other radio shows. And so, night and day, that this type of call comes in. Would you please give me the name of that man that's on the air now, that's on the radio now? Well, madam, this is Happy Long John Whoopi. Why do you have such a man on the air? As a matter of fact, I want that man taken off the air right now. It's coming out of my radio, and I can't stand it. One more minute. I will not stand for it one more minute. That program has got to go off my radio now. Well, madam, he's been on the air for 17 years now, and he's got 400 million. Are you arguing with me? I'm a listener. Are you arguing with me? Who do you think you are, young lady? Give me your name and address, and I'll have you fired, too. I'll have you fight. What's the name of the engineer? I'll have you. And it goes on and on and on and on. And it's a certain nuttiness now that is, it's creeping by leaps and bounds. Nothing ever throws them more than to try to throw logic at them. You try logic on them, and that's deadly. Any cop who deals with nuts all day long will tell you, don't give them logic. Give them a belt behind the left ear. That's the only logic. Throw the net over them and into the chute. That's the all. Down the chute, into the river. That's the end of it. It's about all you can do. As a matter of fact, once in a while, somebody will say, try to bring a little logic. And they'll, well, you know, such a thing like this. Well, madam, this program has many listeners. You wouldn't want everything to be just for you, would you, madam? Well, then there is a short, indignant pause. I should better say a short, indignant, pregnant pause. And she says, "What? What's up?" And the person we usually refuse, "Well, madam, you don't expect all the programs to be for you." "What do you mean? Of course! I'm a listener!" Somehow people seem to think that a listener is paramount or tantamount to being a customer. It's a very different thing, Daddy. You're not paying a lousy nickel for this. And somehow the listener who listens feels he's doing you a favor by listening to your program, which is coming to him free. That's an interesting twist. I guess it's the Macy syndrome. You know, the big sign that says the customer is always right. And the customer comes there, and you can see he's worn the bathing suit now all summer. There are 3 cigarette holes in the rump, and you can see he's worn it out very thin in certain places. He brings it back and says, "His bathing suit is no good. It's no good. I bought it yesterday afternoon. It's no good. Rotten bathing suit. Doesn't fit." And, of course, it's now October 2nd. The wind is howling over Jones Beach, and the ice is coming up on Coney Island, and he wants to trade it in. And Macy's does. You know? Macy's always does. And so I think this is part of the current nudge that people have, a current thing they have, that says, in effect, "I am right because it's me." That's enough. It's me. And people are shocked when you say to them, "Well, being a listener isn't enough, madam. That doesn't make you right." Well, this is you might as well take the Lord's name in vain. Speaking of the Lord, this is WOR, AM and FM, New York. And you've got a little thingy there for us, Charlie, in there? Yeah, all right. All together now, gang.
We're now going for a ride.
Oh, this is a great one. I can't. Go on, bring it up here.
10,
Eddie,
20,
shall we do it?
30, 40, 50. We're cruising
this
at
exciting,
70 miles an hour.
Wow.
Quick, wasn't it? And
yeah.
Quiet. Let's give it a little more gas.
This guy's a nut that's driving.
60.
Hey, come on, fella.
70.
Hey, watch him.
80.
Hey, look out.
90.
Look out.
And
boom. All right. Play it straight. Play it straight. Go ahead. Let it rewind. I'm sorry. That commercial just lends itself. Go right ahead. Play it. Play it out there for the. Yeah, it takes. All right. You rewind it there. It's being rewound now by our vast electronic machine. Walt can rewind it quicker by hand. He's better than that rotten machine we got there. And I don't know if this machine never reads Durrell either. Here, press the button. Now, is it all set in there? Well, you're just going to have to tell. It's still rewinding. Man's triumph over himself. Here it comes.
We're now going for a ride in
this guy's still a
Volvo Compact.
He hasn't changed
10,
at all.
20, 30, 40,
what?
50. We're cruising at 50 miles an hour.
There he goes.
Quick, wasn't it?
Yeah,
and quiet.
Right,
let's give it a little more gas.
Yeah, that's right.
60.
There we go.
70,
see those foxtails flying up?
80. 90 miles an hour, and there's more left. Doesn't strain like a compact, does it? Feels solid like a sports car. Now we'll slow down while you mull this one over. Volvo compacts run away from other popular price compacts in every speed range. Get over 25 miles to the gallon like the little economy cars and are virtually indestructible.
Where was this recorded?
Your dealer has 4 Volvo compacts to choose from. 3 sedans and a station wagon that drives like a sedan. Since you're out driving anyhow, go over and see him.
There you go. Is he through? Don't listen to all that jazz. This is a very good car. In fact, among automobile aficionados, the Volvo is considered one of the finest. As a matter of fact, one of the finest cars made in the world today, and has been compared with very famous German cars that have 3-pointed stars as their insignia. No, it has, as far as workmanship and design is concerned, a magnificent machine. And in Sweden, they use them for an average of 11 years and some of the most rugged driving and terrain in the world. Great automobile. Some night when it won't be logged as a commercial, I will tell you a story of a night that I spent in a Volvo 544 in the biggest snowstorm that New York has had. Do you remember in 1958 or 59? The next day, they cut out all the traffic in New York. Do you remember that? Well, I spent that night driving a Volvo from here all the way on up to Mystic, Connecticut, and back in the most insane night. That cars, believe me, there were cars stalled for here. Oh, well, the Volvo's made for snow. You don't believe it? No, I didn't stay home. I was in a Volvo, seriously, and I was an Army colonel with me. But nevertheless, this is a real machine, and we'd suggest you see Kingsfield Motors over on Eagle Street, 186 Eagle Street in Englewood. I used to be a customer of his out there. I had a Porsche at the time. Well, I almost did a... let's do another thing. Let's do... Oh, yeah, Peter and Mary Lynn Hayes are on every morning at 9:15. I haven't heard him yet. And I'll have to... I never get up that early in the morning. It's just crying out loud. I'm sure that Peter and Linda... They're very clean-limbed people. I doubt whether they stay up this late to hear me either. Of course, I'm not one of the official people. I don't know whether they'd ever listen to me anyway. I'm not what they call a N-A-M-E. Speaking of of the time of the locust and all associated problems, I wonder about the problem of the growing intolerance that people have. It is growing, you get. I feel that there is just a certain quota of intolerance in everybody, and where the intolerance goes, what direction it takes, is shifty. Sometimes it'll be directed towards another race. Sometimes it'll be directed towards a minority group, something like that. And then if it is taken away from that particular phase of existence, it shifts. It's just like we all have a certain number of years in our body. People live an average of about 70 years, and that's it. Nobody ever lives to be 590. I think everybody has a certain quota of intolerance. Now, where you use it, where you spend it, varies from time to time. And I think right now we are spending it on what could be called unorthodoxy. I think unorthodoxy today is probably the most maligned of all qualities. In fact, in most organizations, I know right here, a good example of it is right here in the radio industry, unorthodoxy is paralleled with, and in fact is equated with, unreliability. Unreliability. A man, if he's unorthodox, it's funny, Ed. You know what my reputation is here among the upper echelon at WR. It's as being unreliable. Are you aware of that? Unreliable. That's a fact. And I can't remember the last night, the last time that I missed a show. It goes back like 500 years, and I always do my best. Some nights I don't do such a good show, but it's not because I'm unreliable. It's because I'm not talented. You know, that's something else again. Well, there are other guys on the station. I mean, that flub along, and a lot of guys are very big with the time, very good with weather forecasts, things like that. But on the other hand. No, it is true that if you are unorthodox, you are paralleled in many areas of American life today with unreliable. It's a kind of unthinking, unreasoning sort of thing that unorthodoxy takes many forms. If, for example, you go to the office and you don't dress quite like everybody else, now your performance is largely ignored for an emotional evaluation of unreliability. A man may be the greatest salesman in the organization, but he can become unreliable if, say, instead of living in Westchester, let's say he lives on the Lower East Side. He decides he likes to live down on Avenue A over a delicatessen. And instead of taking the gang to a French restaurant for a big sales meeting, he takes them to some place where he can get gigantic pastrami sandwiches and whitefish. Believe me, within a very short time, he is called an unreliable nut. It really is. It's that's a truth. You have to do things according to a certain set of predetermined techniques. Now, whether you do them or not is beside the point. I wonder how much of our life is completely loused up because of predetermined concepts, ideas of this kind. And I'm certainly not exempting myself. I just wonder how many things are balled up, how many things are missed, how much of existence goes right down the drain because of writing off people, writing off ideas, writing off even emotions or passions because of the unorthodoxy of the people, emotions, and passions involved. Just curious about that. How much of our life is just completely destroyed by a kind of blind, unreasoning, herd orthodoxy. And I'm not even going to use the term conformism, because that term has been overused. I don't think anybody consciously conforms. I think it's so unconscious that it's almost impossible to eradicate. It's a kind of insane orthodoxy that looks upon any deviation from that orthodoxy as being subtly and very mortally dangerous. Socrates, you know, talked about this. This is not a new problem. It's a very old problem. And orthodoxy is valued in life, and of course, especially in an organized society. But as the society becomes more and more organized, and ours certainly is becoming that, any technological society with a great population must become, in the end, a totally organized society. That then, in the end, one of the most valued qualities of a man or a unit, you can't even call him a man anymore, a unit in an organized society is orthodoxy. Because orthodoxy is necessary to organization. Unorthodoxy really is diametrically opposed. Unorthodoxy really is anti-organization. And so, in the end, if the organization has become a great and totally overpowering machine... Of course, another thing, too, that usually militates in favor of that is the most orthodox, as you're aware, Ed, having been around for a long time in this racket, the most orthodox usually arise and become the leaders merely because of the staying power of orthodoxy itself. Staying power. The one thing that the orthodox do have, and that is a tremendous talent for self-preservation. Generally because the Orthodox don't have any real principles. Their one principle is orthodoxy, and their next big principle is usually self-preservation. And usually they will arrive at self-preservation through orthodoxy. So when your great principle, guiding principle, is to preserve yourself, you will become the most orthodox of men. This has always been true. It's certainly been true in great totalitarian societies. The orthodox man is the perfect totalitarian denizen. He's not a totalitarianist. He's a liver in a... He's a perfect man for a dictatorship. The perfectly orthodox man. Primarily because a dictatorship requires orthodoxy of an extreme, almost a maniacal degree. And so if, say, you are a member of society in Hitler's Germany, believe me, unorthodoxy didn't last more than 20 minutes, especially if it was loud. Oh, no, just can't make it. If you're really unorthodox, say, in communist Russia, you're in trouble, really bad trouble. Civilizations, if you can call them that, societies is a better word, these societies were one of the first in the world to proclaim orthodoxy, as a positive virtue. In fact, they're constantly giving speeches about what they call the cult of personality, which is to say the cult of the sorehead, which is to say the guy that stands and says, look, I don't believe it, you know, this is a terrible thing. Other societies will follow suit, not by proclamation, but by action, which is even more deadly, because when something is by proclamation, you can always tear the proclamation down. But when it's by self-consent, you can never tear it down. It'll take hundreds and hundreds of years, if ever, to where a self-proclaimed dictatorship of orthodoxy out. You just can't wear it out, because it will go on and on and on. And today, of course, in most of our creative world, almost all of the creative arts, television, radio, music, And that even goes on, I think, even in the legitimate theater. Orthodoxy is rewarded. It is rewarded a tremendous reward. In fact, it has become a virtue. It's no longer a used to be orthodoxy was something that you when you said, oh, that was an awfully orthodox piece of work, that was a terrible thing to say. But today, orthodoxy it's never said, but it's applauded, which is is even more deadly. It's an intriguing problem. And so have you noticed today, if you take a look at the Broadway theater as an example of it. That there are very few new things going on Broadway this season. Years ago, at this time of the year, the papers were full of new plays, new playwrights, new ideas, new concepts being tried out. Now, a new concept is to bring an old play in from England. This is the current curse. If you're wondering why that is, well, the producers have found out a long time ago that almost all of the critics are Anglophiles. That almost all of the critics immediately quiver with great appreciation as soon as an English actor appears on the stage and announces he is playing Richard III. That automatically means this is important. This is theater. This is literature. This is history. This is acting. It's all the big things. And so you're halfway home right there. Just by bringing in something from England. Now, the other reason, of course, why this is becoming a big thing with producers is that most of the plays that are being brought in from England, you know, are not new at all. Most of them have been running for maybe 2 or 3 years in England and are tested, tried, true, and are already big smash hits. So it's not much of a gamble, you know. Not at all. And this is what's happening. Of course, then again, they find, and this is a kind of a nutty thing, too, that works in a strange way, that a producer will be applauded for bringing in a tried-and-true play. He will be applauded as being a brave, quality producer, which is what everybody wants to be applauded for anyway. So why take risks? And in short, orthodoxy is a big virtue today. It makes it all the way up and down the line. Now, probably, of course, there's different kinds of orthodoxy now. Now, don't think for a minute because you're living in McDougal Street that and you're digging the Chad Mitchell Trio or you're listening to Joan Baez that you're not being orthodox. No. There are different types of orthodoxy. In a society, there is. See, I believe that a society is usually divided into several segments, and each segment of that society, whether it's an intellectual segment or it's an economic segment, or even if it's a social segment, each segment of that society will subscribe to certain orthodoxies, which seem to be unorthodox to the other segment of the society. In short, there are certain orthodoxies which exist below 14th Street. Let's say in the Village, we'll give that as an example. Total orthodoxy, which was looked upon as unorthodoxy, to say to somebody who lives on in the upper 50s, in the silk stocking belt. This looked very unorthodox to him. But he does not realize that he is really looking at another form of orthodoxy. Now, in his own world, of course, orthodoxy is paramount, just as it is you'll find in most of the coffee shops. Another kind of orthodoxy is paramount. Now, the one who is truly not tolerated is the one who seems unorthodox to both camps. That's the one who will be destroyed, the truly unorthodox. In short, the truly unorthodox is the one who is not committed to one or the other or the other or the other pattern of behavior. We're getting into some wild stuff here. It's probably, but nevertheless, it is quite true that and of course, what means orthodoxy? Well, that's a complicated question. The unorthodox is something which the truly unorthodox. Now let's get into this. We must make some definition of terms. I define the orthodox as that which is easily tagged, labeled, and is definable. In short. It has a label. Now, that label may be, quote, he's a nonconformist. Now, that's an orthodox position, because if you look carefully, you will find that he is standing with 17,000 others of his type, all with great big signs that say, ban the bomb, or a sign that says, the living theater is making it, or a sign that says, something like love, or whatever. But the point that I'm making here is that you'll find that so many of them are really going along with a very orthodox line. Now, orthodoxy involves dogma. In short, there are things which a man in a certain camp will believe in, not so much from his own reasoning or his own experience, but because it is in the air in his group. It's zeitgeist. It's in the air. He believes a certain thing. Now, if I go down south of 14th Street, I can make out a list. I could sit right down now and make out 25 things that I'd say probably 8 out of 9 of the citizens I meet on the street will subscribe wholeheartedly to. On the other hand, if I go uptown, and I hate to use a geographic, I'm using it only symbolically here, if I go uptown and I drop into, say, the university club, I can make a list of 25 things which I will find they will subscribe to without question. And among one of the things they will subscribe to, of course, is that the other camp is they're nutty. There's a nuttiness down there, or there's a nuttiness up there, depending on which side of the orthodoxy line you live in. Now, the one thing that they will agree on, and that is that there is a certain group of people that both of them can't stand. Those are the truly unorthodox. And there are not very many, that I will agree. But I'll say one thing about them. They're the people who people are always say, well, what does he do? What does he call himself? You know, that kind of thing. Well, what? And nobody quite knows. Nobody quite can say. Nobody quite can put it into words, or can put it even into a paragraph. The unclassified is the one thing that most of us are most afraid of, the undefined, whatever it might be. It's interesting to see that whenever a fear is defined, somehow we feel better about it. So if you can measure exactly how many million people an A-bomb or an H-bomb or an N-bomb or a Q-bomb will kill, and in how many seconds it will do it, somehow you feel better about it. It's now classified, and you can go about your work. This is one of the things all this testing is about, by the way, just to find out little things like that so you can feel better about that. If we could say, for example, we could know, let's take a religious orthodox view. If we could know the day of Armageddon, somehow we would feel better about it. And in a nutty way, feel more worried. I'm curious, if you knew that Armageddon, let's just take a philosophical stand here. If you knew, if somehow we knew for sure, let's just say without questions, theoretically, if we knew for sure that the world will come to an end, let's say on 2274, April 14th at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, how would you feel about it? Now, the chances that you have no chance whatsoever of you living to that date. How would this affect your life? How would you react? What would that do to civilization? It's an interesting thought, and it would do a lot. Don't think for a minute it would go on just the way it goes on. No, it wouldn't, even though it would not affect any man living in the world today. It would nevertheless alter our entire mode of behavior. Entire. Which, again, leads us to a consideration of the term the defined and the orthodox. Yeah. Everybody's throws it right. Now, the orthodox, have you noticed how the orthodox is so much a driving force today? That it is almost impossible, and believe me, I say this as a car nut. I'm a car buff. It is almost impossible to tell one automobile today from the other. Almost impossible. You have to be right up next to it, And in fact, there was even one commercial that admits such a thing. Did you see the commercial with the roadblock? Very effective commercial. It was on today's World Series games, a very effective commercial. But listen how inadvertently we betray the truth. The guy stops a car, a policeman. And now, if there's anybody who sees a lot of automobiles, it's policemen, naturally. And let's face it, automobiles, they're constantly identifying cars. Looking for a gray Pontiac and so on. So here's the way the commercial starts. You see this guy driving along a dark road, and up ahead is a roadblock, police. You see the lights flashing, he stops. And then you see this cop, big state cop, goes all over his car with a flashlight. He goes around the back, around the front. He goes around, looks at the grill. He walks all around the car in silence. Very effective commercial. And it's dark. And then he walks up to the window and he says, "What kind of car is this?" Which means that the automobiles so look alike now that even with a flashlight you can't identify it. Standing next to it, being a state cop. Well, he goes up to the guy, and the guy says, "It's a Plymouth." Well, I looked at it. It looked exactly like all the other cars that you see. Now, here is, of course, what the Orthodox must do. All Orthodox ideas must masquerade as unorthodox, because the term Orthodox is a term we don't like to hear. We don't like to think that we think in a certain straight-line pattern. So all the way down the line, the Orthodox must always proclaim itself to be unorthodox loudly. And so every commercial will say, the all-new, the brand-new, new from stem to stern, a new concept in automobiles. And this car comes along, and you can't tell it from any car on the road. And the voice is saying, "Yes, a totally new concept all the way, redesigned totally, completely, a new experience, an absolutely new way of driving." And it turns out to be the same old car in the same old way, with the same old four wheels and the same windows and the same whole shebang. There are at least four cars today that are advertising their new automobile as a totally new concept. And each one looks more like its predecessor. It's amazing, you know. It's like if a daughter could look even more like her mother than her mother looks, you know. But orthodoxy today is a very dynamic affair. Dynamic, by that I mean it's a spreading thing. It's a thing that is marching. And orthodoxy in politics, this is becoming a big thing, a big positive virtue. Orthodoxy all up and down the line is becoming probably one of the really dangerous things in our civilization. Now in other countries they have proclaimed orthodoxy. In short, there is a political doctrine or dogma. A set way of thinking towards it doesn't seem to be out of order to a Russian, for example, in a proclaimed Orthodox society, for the president or the head or the premier to make artistic judgments. In short, Khrushchev can say, "All those paintings are rotten paintings. I believe that terrible bourgeois, the awful bourgeois decadent element in so-called expressionist painting must go. Nyet, nyet, go." And by God, that goes. And nobody in Russia seems to question the right of him to do that. That is a totally orthodox view that it covers the whole spectrum of existence, until finally it gets to the point where orthodoxy involves even what is practically by definition unorthodox, artistic creation. And that's the final statement of orthodoxy, when artistic creation itself is regulated not by taste or by definition of people themselves, or by you might say the mood of society and the artistic conscience. It is defined by fiat and defined officially. There are a lot of ways that it can be defined. It can be defined by official fiat, but then on the other hand, it can also be defined by critical fiat in a sneaky way. Critical fiat It's very, of course, we have a presidium of seven who can cast into outer darkness the truly unorthodox, so they, if they desire, and do it. Of course, they will deny it, just as Khrushchev denies that he affects the artists of his country. You know, he does. He really does. Nuttiness? Oh, yes, he does. He says, we believe in the true artistic reality, the true artistic expression of a man reaching into his soul for the truth. Of course, what he's saying is that we believe in the guys painting the way I think they should paint, or the way it's official to paint, and they don't believe that they inhibited artists at all there. Not a bit of it. Because when somebody does deviate from orthodoxy, he's not considered an artist. And so if you stop him, you're not stopping an artist, you're stopping a nut. Or a treasonist, or anyhow, however you define him. And so if our kind of dictatorship, whatever it might be, I'm talking about artistic and so on, because one leads to the other, you know, you cannot separate. And I'm not arguing for no criticism at all. This is something else I'm discussing here. There's a peculiar, in fact, to show you how nutty it gets, recently there was an article in Show magazine, I guess it was, and they were talking about the critics. And, of course, there's constantly articles appearing about this problem. And one of the arguments that the guy who wrote the piece used to show you that the critics, that the critical system in New York was way out of kilter, was that the critics often contradict one another. And I thought, this is a great thing. Yes, I would begin to believe the critics if they contradicted one another more. Somehow this guy, in his twisted reasoning, that showed him that critics wasn't good. If there's one thing that a man should be able to contradict another man on, it's an artistic experience. And yet the cry for orthodoxy goes on and on and on. This article was a very thinly disguised cry for orthodoxy, disguised under the banner of being for unorthodoxy. So you've got to be very careful, you know. Oh, incidentally, one thing you should do, among everything else, keep your glove oiled. You never know when you might get a hard shot at you, Dad. And keep your knees awful loose.